We have a water crisis. And when I say we, I'm talking about Americans. More than 2.2 million Americans have no access to running water or basic plumbing, like a flush toilet. When we look at non-white communities, the problem only multiplies. Native Americans, for example, are 19 times more likely to lack indoor plumbing. Our goal today? Help change the way you think about water. Hello, I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Impact Earth Water. And I am over the moon excited to have with me George McGraw, founder and CEO of Dig Deep. George, I couldn't wait for this interview.
I've been looking forward to it too, Gina. Thanks for having me.
It's going to be especially on the heels of the Thule sisters that I now want to go like shadow them in life because they are so amazing what they're
doing. Collect some samples. Yeah, I mean, they are really incredible.
Oh my gosh, they really are. So you are indeed the founder and CEO of Dig Deep, which I thought the wording was very interesting. It is a human...
Thank you. My mother came up with it.
I love that. I mean, I really, really love that. And you also call it a human rights nonprofit working to bring running water into the homes of Americans currently living without. And before we do the deep dive into the domestic water crisis, I'd like to know a little bit about the backstory. What were you doing before digging deep?
You know, I studied international law, and I've always been fascinated by water. I was like that kid where your mom would take you to the zoo, and she'd go to buy the tickets, and she'd turn around, and I'd be like stripped naked playing in the fountain at the entrance. But you know, for all my obsession, I never met a single person growing up without access to running water. I remember on my father's family farm in Ohio, there was an old outhouse that no one used anymore. And I used to think to myself, oh my God, can you imagine like getting up and going outside
no.
to go to the bathroom? We'd go there in the winter and the fall, especially, and be, oh, so cold. I thought if you wanted to work in water and sanitation, you had to work abroad. So, you know, the beginning of my career and actually the sort of mostly unknown story of Dig Deep is that our first work was in South Sudan and in Cameroon, building systems for people in East and West Africa who don't have access to water. And only after finding out that this was a problem in our own backyard did we really take our time, attention, and resources and come home.
But is it really true that you, I'm assuming this is true, I mean, and I really did do the deep dive into all, I was clicking and clicking and clicking. I had the most wonderful Sunday afternoon learning more about it. But I think most people in the United States, even caring, highly evolved, living consciously people, do not think that there are as many people in our own country without clean water. Would you agree with that conclusion?
100%.
Okay, so you got a check from a $50 donation from a woman who said she wanted it to help people in the United States. Did that help launch this or have you take a look at it? Or was it just... how did that was noteworthy in the stuff that I read.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, it wasn't a check. It was a phone call. We had this woman named Karen call our office, and she was like, I've been calling every organization I can find. I'm just trying to get someone to take this $50 donation off my hands and spend it in the U.S. And I remember being like, Karen, why don't you let me spend your gift, you know, where someone really needs it and somewhere, you know, like South Sudan. And she was like, you are an idiot. I remember thinking, what? She actually had been in rural New Mexico on the Navajo Nation, where those Thule sisters you just interviewed are from. And she was doing a sort of habitat style project, building houses. And the houses they built wouldn't have kitchens or bathrooms. And Karen was like, you know, turned to her.
Yeah,
Navajo coworkers, and was like, well, what's going on here? And they're like, well, this area doesn't have running water, so there's no sense in putting in a sink or a toilet. And she was just so floored to find out that, you know, as many as 40% at the time of people on the Navajo Nation still don't have access to running water or basic plumbing, you know, the kind of stuff you and I completely take for granted. And so she was determined to spend this $50, you know, find someone who would do work in the U.S. And she must have called, I don't know, 10, 15 organizations before she got me on the phone. At the time, it was just me and another friend working on Dig Deep, again, doing that work in Africa. And I have to say, my curiosity was so piqued. I was like, what are you talking about? Everyone in the U.S. has access to water. Which, you know, sounds so ignorant now, but I got in her car with her and drove the 10 hours from my front door in Los Angeles out to rural New Mexico. And, you know, that completely changed definitely my life and professional trajectory, but it completely changed the work that Dig Deep does.
And I want to talk a little bit more about the work you do, because from what I could do in my research, I don't think anybody is doing exactly what you're doing in this country. I mean, you got it, it's, you know, and I want to sound like I really know what I'm doing. It's a WASH nonprofit, water, sanitation, and hygiene.
Oh, good work.
And I did, I mean, I literally went down the rabbit hole on Sunday. It was a overcast day, and I kept reading and reading and reading, and I'm obsessed with this whole thing, too. So paint us a picture of how bad it is in the United States, because we're going to end this show with hope and a call to action to buy a sink or something. But how bad is it? Because you're one of the first organizations with the U.S. Water Alliance to ever do a national study, and it was in 2019, and I'm sitting there by myself in my room saying, how can this be? It was the first ever study, and it was in 2019. So how bad is it here in the United States?
Well, I mean, you know, most people don't know how bad it is, because before it was bad, it was mostly good. You know, we've made some massive investments in water and wastewater infrastructure in this country, starting with the New Deal. But the way we made those investments was uneven across the country. Some communities we served, others we didn't. Sometimes because they were too rural, unknown, many times because of structural racism. But in any case, we're left with a situation today where 2.2 million Americans, at least, don't have access to basic plumbing, meaning they don't have a sink or a shower or a toilet or hot or cold running water. Many tens of millions, maybe as many as 50 million more, have those things but don't have water that's safe coming out of them, which is also just astounding. And you mentioned in your intro that race definitely is a critical factor here. Race is the strongest predictor of whether or not you and your family will have running water in the United States in 2021. Native Americans are 19 times more likely than white families not to have access. Black and Latinx families are twice as likely. But I think in all of that research that we've done and on all the time we've spent in community, the very craziest thing to me is that in six states and in Puerto Rico, we seem to be going backwards, meaning there will be fewer people next year that have access to water and sanitation than they do this year. And it seems like that it might be the first time in our national history that that's happening.
And so you know what my next question is, because I was all over that. Why? Why are we backsliding? And it's the Navajo Nation, which, you know, that's a whole story in itself. Mm-hmm. Appalachia, the Deep South, Alabama, Mississippi, West Virginia, Northeast Kentucky, I think. Why are we backsliding? Is it because of extreme weather and flooding or the pipes are aging out? I'm sure you know the answer. Why is it getting worse?
Well, it's all of those things and more. So, you know, you mentioned a few regions there. We took a sort of a hotspot approach to this study. You know, it's 2.2 million Americans nationally, and we think that's probably an undercount. But then we really looked at maps to see where they're concentrated, and we sent researchers into these communities to live and work alongside people, to do site visits and listening sessions and interviews, and to get at exactly the question you're asking, like, what is causing this? And I think more importantly, for the purposes of our work as a WASH organization, great job on the acronym.
I did my homework, George.
Good. It shows. More importantly, for our purposes, like, how are people coping? What are they doing, you know, to survive on a day-to-day basis? Because I think, you know, the one common thread in all of these communities that I've visited is that while you or I might wake up and the first thought that comes through our mind is the weather or our work day or, you know, whether our kid is going to get into college, for these 2.2 million plus Americans, the first and only thought that enters their mind in the morning is, how am I going to get enough clean water today to survive? And it's because they were not invested in the first place, never had the access to infrastructure that others did. And since then, government funding has fallen off a cliff. It's only 9% of what it was in 1977. And a lot of that funding is tied up in loan programs where people have to saddle themselves with debt just to get the same access that the rest of us got for free. You're right to mention, you know, infrastructure breaking down, especially with the specter of climate change ahead. We're looking at a massive multi-trillion dollar infrastructure deficit in this country. You know, the money that we should have been investing in water and wastewater lines to keep them up to date and functioning, you know, efficiently, hasn't been invested. And those systems are falling offline. We're seeing massive water main breaks. We're seeing what's happening in Houston, for instance, with the water grid going offline at the same time as the electrical grid during those winter storms. And with, you know, increasing pollutants in the atmosphere, increasing sort of severe weather patterns because of climate change, like unfortunately, this is only going to get worse. And so now is the time, I think, as Americans to wake up and close this water gap once and for all so that we can all sort of confront this new reality together on equal footing.
And the thing is, we're going to go into, before we go into COVID, because you think about how bad this would be, and then I think about how sore my hands got from washing them and putting hand sanitizer on them, never giving a thought that I wouldn't have any water. I just wash my hands all the time. So I want to know what you do there, what you have done, because you've been there for a while, and on the Navajo Nation is what I mean. And because when I mentioned to Crystal Tooley and Nikki Tooley your work, I mean, they're like, they love you and you already know that. And I said, I'm going to interview him next week. So what does your work look like on the Navajo Nation?
Well, for those of your listeners, I almost said readers. For those of your readers.
Kelly does such good show notes, they might just read the show notes.
they might just. I was definitely the kid that read the inside of every album. So for those of that don't know, the Navajo Nation is the largest indigenous reservation in the United States. It takes up parts of Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico, kind of where those states and Colorado meet in that Four Corners region. And there are about 170,000 people living there. As I said, up to a third of them without running water or basic sanitation now. And the Navajo Water Project was really founded as one of the biggest programs now at Dig Deep to solve that need, to help families who maybe live really far from water lines and difficult to reach areas, for whom, you know, normal water systems that might serve, say, your neighborhood or your suburb just aren't possible, to serve them with the same hot and cold running water that the rest of us have, but using a different technological and social approach. So where, like, you know, we go over and turn on the tap and water comes to us through an underground line from a water treatment plant, you know, from water that's pulled out of the ground or reclaimed from a river system in LA, where I live, usually from the Colorado River. There, we're developing wells, bringing them up to public water system standards, purifying that water, pumping it into trucks, and then in many cases using truck drivers, some of whom are, school bus drivers who are just in between their morning and evening bus routes, and they're trucking that water to people's homes where we store it safely underground in big cisterns and use solar power to pump it into the house through sinks and showers and toilets. And those families get the same hot and cold running water that you and I have at home, Gina, but it's a system that has given them that access for the first time, and they've participated in building it. Like, they own it and operate it and manage it, and that's the exciting thing. I mean, yes, I started the Navajo Water Project, but I don't run it anymore. It's completely indigenous run from top to bottom.
And you look at what they're doing and the joy, the videos on your website. I mean, it's just unbelievable because you see it up close and personal. And I want to add that you put those cisterns in the ground, and guess what, folks? They have to be refilled every month. It's not like they got to dig a well.
More frequently than that, even. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's, I'm sure, depending on. So are you up to date on, I know how hard COVID hit the Navajo Nation. There was a lot on television, and they exceeded New York in death per capita. How much of that had to do with water?
Well, no one knows for sure, but I can comfortably say, after a lot of conversations with, you know, public health specialists and Navajo Nation tribal government, a lot of it had to do with water. I mean, imagine you live rurally and, you know, this new virus comes in, and if you're lucky enough to have access to the internet or public information about it, then you know to stay home and you know to wash your hands. Those are the only two things we could do at the beginning that would for sure keep us safe. Stay home and wash your hands. Well, if you don't have access to water and sanitation at home, neither of those things are possible. You're always being forced to break social distancing or social isolation to go collect the water you need for the day. And you might get in your car if you're lucky enough to have a job and have gas, and drive 50 miles round trip to pull water home from a grocery store or a gas station. In many cases, people still walk with a bucket and melt snow or pull water from a livestock pond or a windmill. And that water can sometimes, you know, make them sick. And then you have, on top of that, the economic crisis of COVID, people losing their jobs, losing their income, and therefore losing their ability to buy water or to collect water. So the water crisis at the beginning of this COVID pandemic, we were really worried that it was going to intensify on Navajo. But I think we've done some really, and I say we really generously, I think my Navajo colleagues have really done some incredible things to protect their neighbors. I mean, in the first couple weeks of the pandemic, they figured out how to mobilize 2 million pounds of water in just a couple days over 3 states so that, you know, elderly people, people with chronic illness, people with children could stay home and stay safe. They're in the process of, they're still working to mobilize 1,500 storage tanks above ground that sit outside people's homes that are filled every week by this constantly growing network of water trucks and delivery people. And that's water that people can use to cook and clean and drink and bathe and wash their hands. And through this process, we've been able to keep everyone employed and even hire more staff. And so pumping more dollars into local economies to keep everyone afloat.
You know, and as you're talking, I'm sitting here thinking, everybody who's listening, press pause here. We're talking about water, like water to brush your teeth and flush the toilet and take a shower and wash your hair. It's not like it's something on the endangered species list. It's like we take it so much for granted. And I'm telling you, since I started this journey, I do not. And I am mindful of water. And the other thing in the United States, for us, water's free. I mean it. In Tucson, the only thing we pay for is the delivery. We don't pay anything for water. So my water bill is like, I don't know, $40 or something like that. It's ridiculous. I have to ask you this question. I never Please. Try and stump the guest, but I had to get it out and I put it in red on my notes. As I was reading about the Thule's and reading about your work and reading about other water projects, I don't understand why there isn't some big brain, big researcher, big caring person out there that's a billionaire, like Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos or Warren Buffett or Leonardo DiCaprio. Couldn't they take care of just the Navajo Nation in short order? Because what Crystal and Nellie said, it's really about money. It really is, because all this stuff costs money. Is it not sexy enough? Is it not high profile enough? Where is the big money that could fix this? And I could have you on my show in a year and say, everybody on the Navajo Nation has access to clean water.
Oh my God, what a dream. So, I mean, first of all, let's manifest that.
Yes, 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 yes.
I think that would be incredible. The Thule's are right. This is about money. It's not necessarily just about the money that needs to be spent now to solve the problem. It's about the money that was never invested in these communities in the first place.
Right.
When similarly situated white communities got that investment, starting as early as the 1930s. And so, yes, this is about money. I do think it could be solved. I know, for instance, that there is a sanitation deficiency list, which is an ugly way to say, you know, a bunch of needed projects that the U.S. government keeps with the Indian Health Service. They know, like, hey, there are X amount of homes that need X amount of bathrooms, water lines, sinks, connections, etc.
Right.
That could be served by traditional infrastructure. They keep that list. And last time I checked, that list was at somewhere like $5.7 billion, which would serve all of the Native Americans facing this need in the country, from Alaska to Hawaii and all across the continental 50 or lower 48. But it really is starting to get that kind of traction and attention. I think
Great. The
real problem here is that, you know, people just didn't know this was a problem in their own backyards. If you weren't from this community, you couldn't tell this story. You didn't know this story. And so many people from this community were so focused on solving the problem for themselves, they didn't have the bandwidth to tell their stories, which is why I admire Crystal and her sister so much, getting out and working in the field and taking the time to really educate people all around the country about water issues on Navajo Nation. So I'm optimistic. We got our first gift from Jack Dorsey last year, who's a certified billionaire.
Yes, that's
he gave
good.
$1 million, yeah, in COVID relief money to the Navajo Water Project. I'm hoping
I have goosebumps.
That there's more where that came from him and from many others. Because, I mean, the if you take anything away from this interview, it should be that this problem doesn't have to exist. It's completely solvable, and money will solve it. And so. We're out here doing our work in the meantime as Dig Deep to like bang this drum, get people to pay attention and serve as many people as we can with access. But once, you know, attention reaches critical mass, once government really steps in and does its job, I think we could really solve this thing in a matter of years. And you're right, it's the money that's going to get us there.
I think so too. And I hope, I'm doing a plug for my own podcast, but I hope you have time if you're traveling somewhere or whatever, driving in the car, or you live in LA, just listen to their podcast, because there were so many things about it that touched my soul, about them wanting to go back, about the influence of the grandparents, you know, the grandmothers and all this stuff. It was a very emotional show for me, as is this one. I promise not to cry at the end. So what about Appalachia? You're expanding. Mm-hmm. What is it, the same thing there? They don't have clean water, or the pipes are rotten, or the water's rotten? What's the deal there? And what's that project going to look like?
So Appalachia is an example of a community that used to have good water access and has lost it. The issue there, you know, it's a very different issue, but the same result is that, you know, the people don't have access to water and sanitation. I was actually speaking when we were working on that study to this woman named Tori, who helped us with some of our local interviews. And she was talking about having a newborn daughter. And she was like, you know, I had a baby shower and people would give me books, you know, how to care for your new baby. And I'd scroll through the index and I'd be like, you know, where do I read to find out if my water is clean enough for my baby to drink? Or if I drink dirty water from a creek or a stream because I don't have running water at home, is my breast milk safe for my child to drink?
Oh my gosh, I didn't even think about that. And I'm like original La Leche League member from 50 years ago. It's like, yeah. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, really just, I think that's that is the difference between, you know, the average American who consumes 80, 100 gallons of water a day and the people we work with who, you know, squeeze every drop out of maybe a gallon of water a day, stretch it and use it for a bunch of different things. That's the difference, is that there are so many calculations that our fellow Americans have to go through every day just to survive. You know, how am I going to plan my day around how much water I have? Because that determines whether I can go to school, what kind of job I can have, if I can breastfeed my baby. Anyway, Appalachia is a really unique situation where there was once a lot of money in Appalachia, mostly from coal mining.
I was going to say, we know from what?
Yeah, we know from what? From extractive industry and coal mining. And these coal mining companies, you know, built these local economies and in many cases actually set up local water systems. Some of them are called coal camp water systems to this day because they were built to serve coal miners. And then, you know, beginning in, well, several decades ago, there was a massive economic shift and a massive exodus of people. And some of the richest counties in the country became the poorest. And, you know, maybe 80% of the population left. And the people that were, you know, left in these counties, places like McDowell County, West Virginia, where we work, they were sort of left holding the bag. They have this crumbling tax base. There's no money coming into the town. How do they keep up things like water lines? How do they serve each other? And so you had communities start to just fall off where, you know, systems that used to work don't have anyone to maintain them, don't have anyone to fix them. There are no plumbers. There's no money. And so now you have the situation where families very similar to Navajo, you know, wait until it rains to shower under the gutter or drive to collect bottled water because they might have intermittent water access a couple days a week, a couple hours a day. And they can't plan around it because they never know when it's going to come.
Right.
And so the project that we're working on there is in some places to refurbish in partnership with local government those old water systems, to put new safe water through them, replace pipes, redo plumbing in homes. But we're also working in some communities where they truly need an off-grid solution, like Navajo, where they can't be reached by water lines, where the population density is too low or the geography is too difficult. They need something like a cistern system. So we're taking kind of the playbook from all of the work that we did internationally and now in Navajo, the stuff we've learned about what technology is appropriate and what approach is going to work in terms of engaging community and, you know, making sure that they're leading these projects and participating in them at every level. And we're applying that to new areas. And Appalachia is the first with the Appalachia Water Project.
And I'm sure there are, like you mentioned them, some common threads where there's no blueprint because every community is different culturally, all of that stuff. But aren't there common threads of, first of all, you said the most wonderful thing. You ask them what they need and you look at their uniqueness. It's not, we're coming in and we're going to do this, this, and this. You look at the needs. So what are some of the other, you know, we really want to have this no matter where we go. Do you have any of those scalable components that you consider?
Well, I think the scalability question is really around our approach. You mentioned earlier that we're a human rights organization, and we say that to distinguish ourselves from a charity. Like, we're not a charity. People, it's not just nice for people to have water access.
I love that.
It's their right to have access to water and sanitation. They need that to live with dignity. And fundamentally, it's the role of the government to get it to them. But in the absence of that happening, you know, we are stepping into that void and serving them. And I think as a human rights organization, we take that role as a catalyzer of a community's own work to solve its own problems really seriously. You know, we don't come in and apply a cookie cutter approach and say, you know, here's what you get and here's what we're going to build and we'll see you later.
Right.
You know,
we really come in hope you like it.
Exactly. And this turns into really interesting things. I mean, on Navajo, I remember after that first trip out with Karen, I met this woman named Darlene, who, you know, locals affectionately refer to as the water lady, a grandma of four, a school bus driver, got a water truck or a little tank donated and would retrace her morning bus route with this truck in between her morning and evening routes. And she'd leave as much water as she could at people's homes. Like, I would pull up with her to someone's house and everyone would flood out of the house with everything that would hold water, like a saucer, a pickle jar, like lining their driveways with all of these vessels, and she'd fill every one of them, and then she'd move on, and she'd be able to get them a couple hundred gallons of water a month, but it wasn't enough. And we had been working on water access in sub-Saharan Africa, mostly building wells. And Darlene said, you know what, I'd really like to have a well at the top of this hill at the end of my route. That way I could fill up all the way to the well, fill up at the well, and then fill everyone all the way, you know, up all the way back down instead of turning home empty. So instead of just starting, we said, okay, let's engage the community. Let's start to have open community meetings, discuss what this is going to look like. At some point in that process, I remember being in a meeting and a woman standing up and saying, okay, so you're telling me you're going to build a well. That's going to double the amount that Darlene gives us from, what, a couple hundred gallons a month to a couple hundred more gallons a month.
Right.
My daughter woke up this morning and she went to school with a bunch of kids who took a shower, you know, and had a healthy meal and washed their hands and face. And she hasn't done that in weeks. And what's a couple hundred extra gallons going to get me? You know, like, I want hot and cold running water in my home like the rest of the country has, like everybody I see on TV. And that conversation and what it sparked in that room and with our team completely reoriented the project. I mean, and really made it what it is today. And it wouldn't be that without community leadership, which I think that is the... That's the scalable element. That's the thing that we bring everywhere that's always the same.
Yeah, and maybe some other time we can just have a session about white privilege. It's like I'm obsessed with it. I just took a 21-day challenge to see how many more layers I had to pull back. But it's just, it's not a mean-spirited thing to say. It's just a reality that I just invite people all the time to think about what that means. So this is one of my favorite questions in when it comes to something like this. It begs the question of how to address the problem. Is it policy? Is it public-private partnerships? Is this one, this is like six questions, but I think you can hang. Is this one issue where actual policy can help address the problem in the United States? And I just want to say one little thing that I read about. The Navajo, the Native American population in Arizona really helped Biden win. Like, really did. He won by 11,000 votes, and he got a majority of every Native American. It was something like 14,000. So you could say they gave him the vote. And I don't want this to be forgotten. So how big is policy, and where do we start creating the noise or making the difference?
Well, policy is the long game and the end game. And I do think it's about creating noise first. I mean, lawmakers and regulators, they have so much on their plate, they can only pay attention to what's right in front of them. You have to make noise around these issues. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and, you know, for a lot of lawmakers, even in these regions, you know, this is a small constituency for many of them. But, you know, the difference in the way this constituency lives, you know, is so dramatically different in many cases without access to basic services like water or electricity. You just want to sort of like walk up and shake them sometimes and be like, you got to pay attention to this. You got to do something about this. How has this not been solved yet? I think that our access work on the ground is important in and of itself. It's the heart of our work. You know, it's getting people access to water and sanitation. It is enabling them to have an education or keep a job or stay healthy or just have some time to play with their kids.
I know.
But what it makes possible when we harness it through the lens of storytelling, allowing local community members to tell their own stories, to make videos like the one you saw, to do reports and research like that Closing the Water Access Gap report that you mentioned, it's a really powerful driver for change because we can take all those things, package them up, and put them in front of lawmakers and regulators in an advisory or advocacy capacity and say, listen, we want to educate you. This is what's going on. This is what it looks like. And it's not just us that care about this. We have 40,000 donors that care about this. And we have, you know, these celebrities and we have Mrs. Green's World. Like we have
now. Yay.
Yeah, exactly. We have all of these, you know, incredible resources and voices at our back supporting these communities. And it's time for you to pay attention and do something about it. And by the way, here's a list of things we want. I mean, that was, I think, one of the most powerful things to come out of the collaboration with the U.S. Water Alliance, some universities, the actual communities themselves in that water gap study was not, it wasn't just a study about those 2.2 million, like this is the number and here's where they live or, you know, why they're living this way. It was also, here's what we need to do to change it. And a lot of those recommendations have to do with changing the way we do business in terms of policy in this country, making funds more accessible, more flexible, going back to funding levels that we haven't seen in decades when it comes to water and sanitation access, changing the way some federal and state programs are run, prioritizing access for communities without access to water. There is so much exciting stuff that can be done from a policy space that will really shift here. And I see on both sides of the aisle, we're reaching some critical mass. Like there is an interest now, a almost thirst, if you'll forgive me, to solve this problem that there really never has been before.
I love it. And if you have Jack Preston, I mean, dude, this is a guy that can really, he has a lot of influence. So his name is not out there all the time about being, doing the environmental thing. That made me very happy. So another question I have is, it's a weird question, but you can take it. On your website somewhere, I went back and I tried to find it. And it said something about if we can learn to love our water, it might just save our lives. And I'm, you know, I was like filled up. I cry easily anyway. I'm proud of it. How do we get people to fall in love with water? I mean, the people that listen to my show are early adopters. We had almost 1 million listens last year.
Wow.
And they take action and they sign up for my newsletter and they give donations. How do we get people to even think that they just flushed the toilet? You know what I mean?
Well, this is, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And this is one of the biggest challenges. And, you know, we face this as an organization. I remember in the early days, we had this board member who was a close friend of mine named John. And he came to me one day and he's like, George, you know, I've been supporting our work in Africa and now in the U.S. But, you know, my daughters are entering school and my wife and I are moving. And I, you know, this issue just doesn't feel real to me. It doesn't feel important to my family because it doesn't touch our daily lives. And so I said, okay, like if that's how you feel, I completely understand. But before you go, I want you to do me a favor. I want you for a whole week, you and your family, to try each of you living on just a gallon of water a day.
Oh my God.
And I mean, that's pretty hardcore, a whole week. I mean, it gets a little smelly after a few days.
Yeah.
But, you know, he did it. He and his whole family did it. And it led to this incredible, incredible understanding. I mean, this eventually became the Four Leaders Challenge, which is where I think you were on our website. The idea is that most Americans don't have, we might have access to water, but we don't have a relationship with our water. We don't love it. We don't understand
it. We
don't think about it. Right. But ironically, the 2.2 million Americans next to us who don't have access to it, they do understand it. They love it. They know where to find it. They prioritize it. They keep it safe. They make it stretch. And, you know, the difference in that is a difference in life experience. It's a difference in perspective. And so one of the ways we're trying to encourage people to shift their perspective is by doing what John did, doing this Four Leaders Challenge. We ask people just to do it for 24 hours now, not a whole week. But for 24 hours, take a gallon of water or take a liter jug and fill it 4 times and make that the only water you use for 24 hours. If you're going to brush your teeth, take it from the bottle. If you're going to drink it, take it from the bottle. If you're going to make some pasta, if you're going to wash your hands, if you're going to wash your armpits, take it from the bottle.
Oh my gosh.
And, you know, measure during the day, like how much water do I have left? And you'll start to think, you'll start to plan your day around how much water you have on land. Like, you know, do I have enough water to smell good enough to go to dinner? Like, do I have enough water to, you know, do strenuous exercise at the gym? Or do I have to kind of keep it low key because, you know, I only have 4 liters and I should probably drink 2 or 3 of them just to replace what I'd lose in the sweat. It's really interesting. So I think all of your listeners, true early adopters, should all do the 4 liters challenge. It really is incredible. And you can find it on our website, digdeep.org/4 liters. And it's a good start.
And you should put me on the spot and say, Gina, are you going to do it? And I'm just cringing. I'm like, I'm not sure, but I bought a sink for Mrs. Greensworth.
Well, you're set up now, Gina. Are you going to do it? Are you going to do the 4 liters challenge?
I think I'm going to have to. Like, I'm just being shamed publicly. And
well, I'm going to be listening to every episode to hear the update.
To see, I have to get buy-in from the family, but I'm going to talk to my husband because he'll do it. My daughter who lives with us, I don't think so. But anyway, it can change your life forever. It does change your life. Water is life. It's our most precious resource. It's the only thing we can't live without. And yet people have to transport it. It just blows me away. And I rarely do like what I call a hard sell at the end. About what people can do. But I think it was before we came on air, or I might have said on air because I'm so wrapped up in what we're doing. But I put a post up on Sunday. It was the most beautiful Sunday. It was overcast, and I spent 4 hours researching for this show. And that means reading and listening to the CBS Sunday Morning broadcast, which was just so great. That's how Kelly found you. And then we found out you knew the Thule sisters. So it's like, oh, it's a family reunion. But anything you can do, listeners, can change someone's life with clean running water. It's $90 for a sink. It's $250 for a solar panel, $4,500 to bring running water to a Navajo family. And if you can't do that, the 4 liters challenge is free. You can fall in love with water at home. So I hope people will do stuff. And when the podcast comes out, I'm going to send it to some of my donors because some of them have the financial ability to support other charities, and they do. And I'm going to write to them and say, and they live in Arizona. So if you're ever thinking about another charity to look for, not charity, I'm with you. Oh my God, a human rights organization. We need to change that language so much. So I'm going to do that. So before I give my final last words, do you have anything that I didn't talk about that I like a big miss or something else you want to add?
No, I so appreciate the amount of time and effort you put into researching this. You really are an expert. I think
I loved it. Oh.
If anything, I'll leave you with a little bit of a story just to really, you know, show how far-reaching the impact is here. I think that I was mentioning that first day I was out with Darlene, the water lady, and she was making her rounds on Navajo. And we pulled up to the house of this woman, Brenda Johnson, who lives with her mother, Lindsay. And, you know, unlike the other houses where everyone sort of came out and helped fill containers and talk to Darlene and talk to me, Brenda came out all business with a cooking pot, and she went right to the side of the truck and filled it off of a tap on the side of the truck and then marched right back into the house. And I was like, I'm going to, you know, follow her and see what's going on, see if I can talk to her. And so she welcomed me into the kitchen where she was making tamales. And I thought, oh, well, you know, that's so nice. She, you know, hungry, making tamales for her family for lunch. Well, she was making these tamales in order to pack them in a cooler to walk a few miles, take them down into town, and to sell them. She sold tamales in order to get gas money, and she really needed gas money because her husband, who worked at a factory, had been in an accident and smashed his foot. And without clean water at home, he couldn't keep the wound clean enough, and it had gotten infected with gangrene. And he'd been in the hospital 50 miles away and had been discharged the previous week, but had to just live on the street because no clean water meant no tamales, meant no gas money, meant she couldn't go pick up her husband who had been discharged from the hospital. Oh. And so, like, the cycle of him not being able to go to work and them not having clean water and having to worry about all of these responsibilities day in and day out, it really just, I think of that situation and the way my eyes were opened that day. That was the day that, you know, I really came to understand what this problem looks like in the U.S. and why it's so important that we solve it. And so I wanted to share it with you.
That's such a real story. It's the power of storytelling, which is what makes your website so compelling. It's about stories. There's no selling on your website. It's sharing stories. And I loved it. So two thoughts to share as I get the last word in. First of all, if you think things are bad now for the 2.2 million people without running water and the almost 50 million without access to clean water, think about how that's going to play out in the face of climate change in the months and years to come. We are already seeing it. Extreme weather, extreme droughts, flooding, mudslides, the list goes on. How much worse might things get for those already suffering? And if you ask me, the answer is very. And unless we take action, we, part of the Mrs. Green's World tribe, and ask others to do the same, unless we get in front of our elected officials and hold their feet to the fire, unless we figure out how to show we care, it's not going to change. And my second thought is just to say that we are walking the walk, as I mentioned. We bought a sink. I did it this morning before I got on the show, $90. And I'm telling you that because I hope it inspires you, our caring, committed listeners, to take some action. And this is another thing that we didn't talk about, George, and you might end up getting the last word. 100% of all the money you donate goes directly to the mission. And that's the same as Scott with Charity Water. They have big, bountiful donors that support the administrative piece. So 100% of what you do supports your mission.
That's right.
So that's a biggie. And if you're like me, the thought of not having running water, hot and cold, at my fingertips is a daunting one. To be honest, I can't even imagine it. If you visit the Dig Deep website or listen to George's interview on CBS Sunday Morning, you might want to drop what you're doing, find George and his team, and go make a difference on the front lines like I wanted to, because I thought, this is what I really want to do. I want to get out there and see impact. George is that passionate, and Dig Deep is that amazing. It is not likely that most of us will run away and join Dig Deep on the Navajo Nation or in Appalachia, but we can all step up to become a part of the solution, even if it means giving up your lattes for a month. George, thank you for showing up in my life and for all you do and for your team and your passion, and I'm sure our paths will cross again.
I hope so. Thanks, Gina. Water's life.
Water's life. Everybody, thanks for listening.